So Dave, we took the Mazda 5 down to the Gulf station because it had to have its state inspection. And of course, get that wonderful news on the phone that we need to do about $1,000 worth of work.
Oh, great. That's the phone call everyone. Yeah, we're going to need to put about $1,000 in this, baby.
Yeah. It's like he gives me the list. Yeah, well, the brakes are bad. And we got to do this and the air filter and the this and the that. And the list just keeps going on and on and on. And I'm like, all right, well, do it. Because, you know, you don't have a choice, you know. And yeah. And I'm like, what's the final gonna be? And he goes, $1,000. And I'm like, all right, well, you gotta do, you know. So he does the work. We pick it up, drive it home, sits overnight. And the next day, Carolyn was gonna take the kids to practice, and she goes to leave, and she gets to the end of the alley behind the house there, and the car dies. And she gets it started back. Oh yeah. And then she gets it started back up. It makes it to the next stop sign, dies. And she said, every time I slowed down and for a stop sign or an intersection, it died. But then she could start it right back up again, but then it died again. So she, you know, nurses it back down to the service station, at which point they're closed for the weekend. And she's like, well, listen, I'm just leaving it here. Because if I try to get it back home, there's no guarantee I'm going to have it towed back. So she's just like, I'm leaving it here in your parking lot. You guys are just going to deal with it.
Right.
And so I got the message Monday, what was wrong with it. And this was just so perfect. The guy gets me on the phone. He says, oh, yeah. He says, we figured out what was wrong. It was a dirtle throttle body. And I go, what? He goes, it was a dirty throttle body. And I realized, Dave.
Throttle? Wait, say that slowly. A dirty throttle body.
A dirty throttle body.
Brad.
And I realized he could tell me anything. I have no. He could say, "Oh yeah, we looked under the hood there. The top hat fell off the snowman. But once we put that back on, you know, it's purring like a kitten now. You know, I. He could tell me anything, and I would believe it because I don't know what's going on underneath that thing."
Brad, you just had the age-old thing happen to you. A made-up word was just thrown at you.
I mean, I've never. Have you ever heard of a throttle body?
Oh, well, Brad, what your problem here, sir, is that you've got a recalcitrant recombinator, and you don't want that. That's gonna be $1,000 for that recalcitrant recombinator. You're gonna want to get that fixed right away, sir. So,
I'm glad that you're a professional. I thought it was my bifurcated invertebrator.
Oh no, this is gonna be your recalcitrant recombinator, sir. That's gonna be. Oh boy, if that doesn't work, then your Jehoshaphat doesn't get the proper ignition sequence.
And then I had my Jehoshaphat calibrated last week, for crying out loud. How can it be
well,
that?
Well, that's your problem, sir. See, and also, there might be, we're not sure yet until we get in there, but it might also be your dirty throttle body. So we're going to have to throw all those in.
What made me curious is that throttle body is such a fun word to say that it almost seems like one of those things that mechanics would just make up when they're not really sure. You know, and it's like, I just tell them it's a throttle body. If nothing else, it'll be fun to say.
Throttle body. Why is that so fun to say? Throttle body.
Because it's poetic without being rhyming. You know, it's got adil adi right in the middle.
It does have an internal rhyme to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does sound like a mechanic doing a cat call. Hey, whoa, look at that dirty throttle body. Whoa, hello.
Yeah, and it's got dirty right in the title. So, you
right.
know, it's instant fun right there.
Dirty throttle body. What a phrase. Dirty
that could
throttle
be
body.
That'd be a great band name.
That would be a good band name. Or an insult that like two kids playing Little League would throw at each other. Why, you're a dirty throttle body.
He can't hit. He's a dirty throttle body.
We want a pitcher, not a belly itcher. Also, you're a dirty throttle body.
Yeah, that you know, when those baseball chants get too long, they kind of lose some of their flavor, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, you start putting asterisks in the insult. You know, we want a pitcher, not a belly itcher. Also, you're a dirtle throttle body, and your mother wears army boots, and I think you might be cross-eyed and have that left leg looked at.
Yeah, and the coach is like quietly clapping. All right, kids, that's enough. Our insults are getting less effective.
Baseball is a slow enough game as it is without you little shits.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. Well, on that note of Dirtle Throtty Buddies, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's hour of comics advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. We have a couple of questions to dive right into this week, so I'm going to throw out the first one to you. Are you ready for this?
Like throwing out the first pitch. Let's keep this baseball theme going. I'm loving it.
Let's keep it going. Just do not call me a dirty throttle body. That's all I ask. That's all I want from you,
no,
Brad.
No, your throttle body is clean and sleek.
Oh, easy there. Hold on. I'm happily married. Do not try to make a move, Brad. This marriage is locked down. I'm sorry. All right, so this question comes into us from Scott McAvoy, or maybe I'm reading that right, McAvoy, I'm hoping it's
McAvoy. I would call it McAvoy.
I'm going to say McAvoy, and hopefully Scott's forgiving if I've done that wrong. I'm not an artist, Brad and Dave, but I do enjoy picking up the occasional original piece from comic artists I enjoy. I have one from Dave, which I really love. Oh, great, Scott. Scott's already in my book. This is great. I already love this question.
Keep reading. He's got one from Dave, and...
And my question is there any...
Oh, Jesus Christ. Nothing else after that? One from Dave and nothing else?
No,
That's all he's got is one from Dave? He didn't mention anybody else in that list?
He said, hold on. Let me read this again. I have one from Dave, which I really love, but I would never buy one from that dirty throttle body. That's his exact phrase.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Okay, here it is. Here we go. Let's get to the question here. My question, though, is there any comic artist you two wish you had an original piece from? Brad Geiger of Philadelphia, PA, currently carless. What is your answer? Is there an original art piece that you are lusting after in your career?
Well, yes and no. So here's the deal. Ever since I got a studio, I've got it with really high ceilings, which is why I'm podcasting once again with a blanket over my head. I've got these great walls to fill with art. And so I really love getting original art to put on them. So my list is so long that it's not even worth listing because, I just love putting art up on the wall. So I'd like to have something from I'd like to have a Dave Kellett, frankly. I'd love
Do you
to
not have
some,
one?
I don't have a Dave Kellett. I don't have a Scott Kurtz.
Wait a minute. I have known you for 20 odd years. I've never given you original art.
I've got one thing that you did that was, you remember when we were at that convention and we were all handing around sketchbooks and we started doing these just ridiculous, we'd put somebody into the comic and kind of do this joke about them. And there was something, a joke, you had done a caricature of me and it had, the joke had, in fact, it's sitting right above, if I take the blanket off my head, I can see it. But it was something about an overactive bladder and a single tear.
Yeah, that
and
sounds like you.
Yeah. but one of these days I've got to get my hands on a Sheldon. That's among my goals in life is to get that.
That's ridiculous. Hold on, that's ridiculous. Before we go on, that's ridiculous that you don't have one. Pick anyone you want from the archives, and I will send you one tomorrow.
I will send it today.
Why am I saying tomorrow? I'll send it today.
Although I don't know whether I'm on your list or not, but we'll work out a trade. How's that sound?
Nah, that's fine. I'll just send you.
You son of a bitch. Oh my God.
No, I'm just like, I'm good. That's fine. I'll just send you one. That's fine.
How am I going to put that? I've got kids.
No, I would love one. Are you kidding? I would love one.
Let's work on a trade because I'd love to have an original Sheldon. That would be a prize for me. My wife is always looking for Christmas or gift ideas. And I'm like, I love getting original art, you know, and there's so many artists that I like. So many artists that I really, really, although that some of that stuff is it starts to get really expensive. Like if I was really, really, if I had, you know, millions of dollars to spend, an original Charles Adams, I think would be a treasure.
Wow. I did not expect you to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. His work was so clean and beautiful, and he did those ink washes. And I just think his stuff was gorgeous. Plus, he had that dark sense of humor. So many great jokes that I just was so subversive, especially for the 60s and 70s when he was in his heyday. That would be among my treasures if I had millions of dollars to put into, because, you know, obviously his stuff is going to be pretty pretty darn expensive. Yeah, and my wife actually got me a Charles Adams framed print, which hangs in a place of honor here in the studio that I really do. It's the one where they're about to put hot oil down on the Christmas carolers below.
Right.
You know that famous one?
Oh, yeah.
That one framed and matted up in a place of honor here at the studio.
By the way, the layout of that comic is really well done. I remember that one specifically.
He was so great at using composition to direct a joke. Like, it wouldn't be a great joke, but he was so masterful at making your eye go exactly where it needed to go. He could hide something and put it in the scene and make it the last thing you saw. And it was like, oh, my God. Boom, there it is. Yeah, it takes such masterful control over composition to do that it's just like watching a sleight of hand magician. He does it, and it works every time, and you wonder how he did it.
That's exactly like what it is. It's like a sleight of hand magician. You're exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to tell you, though, what a great friend I am. So while you were talking, I was like, you know what? Maybe Brad's birthday's coming up. I'm going to look how much a Charles Adams original piece would be on eBay. There is a sketch, not even a good one, just a sketch of Wednesday Adams. Guess how much it's going for?
Oh, God. I'll bet you $5,000.
$2,800. So guess how quickly I went from I'll get Brad an original Charles Adams. Nope, not buying that for him. Nope, Brad can go eat a bag of rocks. I'm not doing that.
I went from a Charles Adams sketch to a bag of rocks. There was no in between there.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, Brad. Here you go. Friendship.
Have a bag of rocks.
So Charles Adams. All right. So, and then who else did you want besides Charles Adams?
Oh, you know what? The next on my list would be a Ramona Frandon, who did Plastic Man in the 70s. And
wait, what was the name? I don't know this name. Ramona Frandon?
Ramona, and I may be mispronouncing it, because you know how I am with names. But Frandon or Frandon, she was a DC Comics artist who did Plastic Man for an awful long run. And it's just because Plastic Man is one of my favorite characters and so forth. I came real close to buying an original from her once at a comic convention, and I misread the price tag on it, and I missed like the last zero. So instead of $10, it was $100 or something like this. And I was kind of stretching the budget as it was, because it hadn't been a great comic convention. And then when I found out about the extra zero, I had to be in that really awkward position of saying, oh, well, maybe not. And that's when I felt like the extra zero.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm thankful to you for pointing her out to me, because I did not know of her career. And for having worked in the 50s, she's amazing.
Yeah.
She worked on Aquaman, on Brenda Starr, on Plastic Man. She continued to work into her 70s and 80s on SpongeBob SquarePants. What an amazing artist.
And she was during that time period, women in comics art, especially, you know, Marvel and DC, weren't plentiful. And so just the fact that she could swing in those circles, and because, you know, she took a lot of stuff from people, it couldn't have been an easy career. And just the fact that she she was able to do that for so long, and she duked it out, that just makes her stand out in my mind.
Imagine what a shit show it was for her in the 50s to be in a room full of nerds just trying to m'lady her every 5 seconds, which is like, I'm just wanting to work, just let me draw. Like, That must have been miserable, m'lady. So those are your top two, both of which I'm really excited we had this question, because I would never in a million years have guessed either of those for you.
Really?
So now give me one more. What's your top three?
Top three, that's easy. It's Jack Cole. He was up because he combines.
I don't know who that is either. Who's Jack Cole?
There's a great, and also I'm going to throw one more in there that you will know, but Jack Cole was the creator of Plastic Man, but also he was a Playboy cartoonist. So he's got my two like sides of my world. He created Plastic Man, but also he did these great Playboy cartoons, and I've got a book of some of his best prints. He had such a wonderful style that I just sit and ogle his line. Jack Cole would be another one.
Wow, I'm looking at those two segments of his career, and what a different style he had for Plastic Man and then for Playboy. That's interesting.
Yeah. And Plastic Man was pure id splashed on the page. It was just complete frenetic energy. Whereas his single panel work was so much more refined and almost elegant, you know.
Now, lest people on this show think that I'm actually a jerk by saying, oh, I'm not kidding, Brad, Charles Adams, didn't I send you an original Plastic Man comic from 1961?
Yes, you did.
Do you have that up in the studio?
Yeah. In fact, I bought a special frame for it for comic books, and it's up on my wall.
Well, I appreciated the handwritten thank you card that you sent. That was very nice of you. That was really...
I called you an effusively thank you, crying out loud, you and your handwritten.
I want you to know that meant a lot to me, to know that you would, that you would turn around.
My goodness.
That Plastic Man was kindly gifted to me among a group of comics from my friend Todd Grinnell, who plays Schneider on One Day at a Time. He had got a whole series of mid-century to late 20th century comics, and I, knowing that you would want a Plastic Man, I was like, I'm snagging that Plastic Man for Brad. So I passed that one along to you.
There was more than one. You had a small stack of Plastic Man comics.
That's right. Well, yeah, because I said, I know a guy that loves him some Plastic Man. And so let me ask you, before we move on real quick, Plastic Man, what was the deal? Why was he insane? Is it because his brain is elastic and so it can't hold a coherent thought? Is that why Plastic Man was insane?
That's such a great question. So Phil Folio wrote Plastic Man for a very, very short time. And during his tenure, he kind of wrote it into Plastic Man canon that falling into that chemical basically not only gave him rubbery powers, but also gave him kind of like a long-term contact high. So he was basically, it was the long-term effect of huffing those fumes that put him off kilter. And I don't know that that's official canon, but that's the one that I like the best.
The official canon is he is Stoner of the Year and has a little statue that just says Stoner of the Year.
Exactly.
Okay. Good on Phil. That's a fun way to write that. The brief interactions I've ever had with Plastic Man, I've always been aware immediately that he's clearly the insane member of the Justice League. Then everyone else is sort of, all right, Plastic Man, whatever.
But it's also, that's the part of him that makes him so special, is because he's kind of like the man. And this is a trope that I actually don't like in a lot of other places. Strangely and ironically, I hear myself complaining about this trope a lot. But in Plastic Man, I think it works. He's the magical idiot. In other words, there's those characters that are like Mr. Magoo. He's a magical idiot where he can walk down the street and he can't see, but he always magically kind of puts his foot in the right place so he just misses the hole in the street. Right. I don't like magical idiots very much as a
Daffy writer. Duck is kind of a magical idiot a lot of times.
Yeah. But Plastic Man kind of that works for him for some reason. I like that in him, and I actually like it on Daffy Duck. But there's a lot like who was that character in Bone? The tall one, was it Phone Bone?
Smiley.
Smiley Bone, yeah. That I was not crazy about because he was kind of like that magical idiot. But yeah, that's what I like about Plastic Man.
Well, it's kind of written for 9 and 10 year olds, so that's a little bit different.
True. You're like at the time, so was Plastic Man.
I do like the idea though that you're like complaining about a children's book. You're like, I don't know about these little ducklings. Why are these little ducklings following their mother? I don't get it. Just go
these
sit in the pond.
Freaking kittens always losing their mittens. Yeah. I'm done with it.
I tell you what, I'm Brad Geiger, and I don't like these little kittens losing their mittens. Oh, boy, I got to pay for this dirty throttle body. I don't want to hear about these damn kittens and their mittens.
Thank goodness you're still throwing the name into the impersonation. I think that's a good habit to get into.
It is a word that's easy to stumble over, though. Dirty throttle body. You got to take a slow beat at it. All right, so I'll jump over.
Okay. Yeah, what is your top three artists that you'd love? Because now I've been in your studio. You have an impressive collection of originals. So I would think this would be harder from you because you've got a lot already. Who would you want to add to that collection?
Yeah, well, as you know, I'm a super nerd for original art. Almost going back to my grad school days, I did 2 graduate degrees in the history of comics, and I worked as an archivist in the University of Kent in Canterbury, England, archiving their comics. And so I physically handled a lot of World War I, World War II comics and put them in the British archives and stuff, right? And that was really fun for me. But that only fed an already existing love for original art. And so over the last 20, 25 years, I've been collecting a lot. And so the oldest one I have is a Hogarth from 1746. It's a first edition print of that one. And then everything up to mostly late 20th century stuff that I have. But who am I missing that I would really want? That's a big list. But I would love to get a Peanuts at some point. I think that would be fun. Mm-hmm. Depending on who you get it from, as long as you don't try to buy it from Jeannie, because she'll always outprice you. I mean, in terms of her being involved in the transaction, like as long as you're not bidding against Jeannie, because she's actively trying to buy them all back for the museum, right?
Is she?
Yeah, the whole thing. And so, but there's thousands out in the wild. So I would love to get a Peanuts. I would love to get, it's never going to happen, but I would love to get a Watterson, a Breathed, and a Larson for Farside, Bloom County, and Calvin and Hobbes. And then, can I tell you on a different note, though, one thing about Charles Schulz and about Mort Walker, walking into their studios, they were like me and they had all their originals around their drawing desks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And walking into their studios, they got their start in their career right as, frankly, the golden age of comic strips were coming to an end. And so they have originals from all that first generation. And by first generation, I mean 1910, 1920, 1930. So they have things like Popeye. They have Yellow Kid. They have Winsor McCay's. Mutt and Jeff. They've got Barney Google. They've got all the ones, the original Gasoline Alley run. And so you're walking around. And in Mort Walker's studio, in his case, I'm like, oh, wow, Mort, look at those cool Norman Rockwell reproductions. And he goes, oh, no, those aren't reproductions. And I was like, holy shit, you have Norman Rockwells. Oh, my God. He's like, yeah, Norman lived right down the road. These are some studies he was doing for Saturday Evening Post. I gave him some Beetle Baileys and he gave me some Norman Rockwells. And I was like, wow, that's a good trade. So you see some of these older cartoonists and it was a level of artistic lust that I have not had since because those are the unattainables. Like you'll never find another Winsor McCay on the market that's a price anything less than $20,000 or $30,000, you know? Yeah. But they got it by a trade with an older Winsor McCay when they were 25, you know?
Wow.
And so because a lot of that older comic stuff back then just got thrown out. And so, of course, a cartoonist would trade with another cartoonist. Otherwise, the newspaper is just going to throw it out. And anyway, long story short, so those older cartoonists, specifically Sparky and Mort Walker, their collections were amazing.
So okay. Now, wait, I'm going to interrupt you just for a second. You were telling us on an earlier show how the secretary would pull some of the peanuts that that Schultz didn't like out of the trash and yeah. save those.
Yep, yep.
Do you think that they would ever consider selling those?
I don't think so. I hinted very strongly to Jeannie, like, hey, there any-
I was wondering about that. How could you resist?
You know me, I'm polite, but I hinted very strongly. I really laid it on thick with the hints that, boy, I sure would love a peanut sketch if Sparky just left one line in a drawer somewhere. Sure would love that. Ha ha, yeah. Wouldn't that be great? Oh, that'd yeah. be fun to have. And but listen, Jeannie is lovely, and I love her heart, and she's doing right by her her husband's yeah. body of work and collecting it all. So I say that with not an inch of disparagement. And if anything, it was rude of me to
right.
hint.
Yeah, you can't falter for that.
Yeah, no, yeah. I say, if anything, it was rude of me to hint. But I'll find one at some point in my life on the open market and look at my wife and say, do you mind if I drop $1,000 on this pencil sketch? And she'll go, you are a dummy.
You mind if it's either that or a new throttle body.
So the thing is, though, mostly, if I'm being honest about it, my collecting urge has been sated. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you've seen my studio. Like, every wall is covered. Yeah. I've got everything from The Simpsons to Beetle Bailey to Foxtrot to all sorts of stuff. And so I don't know that I need more, you know? I'm yeah. good for the most part.
And you're in that zone that you've got so much now that it's also a little bit of a worry. It's like you've got to insure those now, and you've got to make sure that you've got sprinkler systems and stuff like that, because now you're kind of like a custodian of that stuff.
Yeah, it's true. And the thing is, too, if I had to buy, or if I got one now, or if I acquired a new one by either a gift or buying one has to come down off the wall. You know what I mean? So now it's no longer additive. Now it's subtractive to add to my collection. So I think I'm for the most part, I'm done. I think I'm done.
Well, let's turn from original art to prints, because this we've got a nice little transition to a question that another Patreon backer has sent in that I'd like to bounce off of you.
All right, throw it. Throw it? Well, so, what a weird way to say
that. So Carrie Chu asks, I have a weekly webcomic with a growing Twitter following, and I want to sell prints of individual strips. What is the best practice currently? I looked into print on demand, but either the margins are too low or the required minimum quantity makes it impractical. Am I better off printing at home on a one-off basis as orders come in? And if so, what printer and paper would you recommend for professional results? Also, what is your advice for pricing these prints? And you're going to be a little bit better, I think, than I am, because you've done pretty well in offering prints, have you not?
Well, I have done prints for about 10 years, maybe 15 years, and I'm increasingly less inclined to do them, if I'm being honest about it. And the reason is that the mail for prints used to be really affordable, and it has slowly been inching up as they changed the mail rates, at least in the U.S., postal system for the last couple of years. So the way I do it is there's two kinds of prints that are offered for my work. I do what are unquestionably posters. They're kind of versions of comics that I've posterized. I've either made them into more vector looking art, or I've redesigned them so that the joke that was a comic strip is now a single panel poster, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And I have, in fact, they're here in the closet with me. I'm looking at them. I have about 20 right now that are available for sale of that, right? But then, additional to that, I have 4,000-plus Sheldon strips in the archives, any of which that you could order through Topatico. And the way that works is, as soon as the original art sells, there's a bit of code on the website that subs out for, you know, first it says, buy this original art. And then once somebody buys it, now it says, that's scratched out, and it says over it, buy it as a print. And then when somebody clicks on it, it sends that specific URL to Topatico. They match that up with a file name. They print it out. They mail it out, right? So there's two ways that you could buy one of Sheldon prints. Now, for me, I do the posterized Sheldon stuff down at, of all places, Costco Photo, because they do a really beautiful job on high quality of photo paper, and it does it well. There are also places online that you could get them done cheaper. So you get a quantity of 100, 200, 500 posters or prints made ship them out. That's just a little bit of Googling. But my short version is that you have to store them very carefully. They're increasingly expensive to ship. You have to store a bunch of tubes to keep them at the ready to mail them out, because you don't want to mail them flat, obviously. You don't want to fold them, obviously. So you really, the only best way to mail them is to roll them up into a plastic sleeve, put the plastic sleeve into a tube, and then mail the tube. And all of that is just annoying to store. So I'm slowly phasing out prints from my own business. And then additional to that, one last point that I'll make, Brad, is that at Comic-Con, when you don't have a lot to sell, prints are great. Because they are very pretty and they attract eyeballs to your table. But when you get to my point or your point in Brad's career and you have too many SKUs, like you have more than three books or a bunch of other things, the problem with prints is they take up a lot of table space. And so the value per inch is lessened than versus a pin or a book, you know, because it has this 18 to 20 inch wide poster on your table or print on your table. So just keep that in mind. Brad, what are your thoughts about prints? What would you recommend?
I think if it was me, here's the deal. I have never had much success selling prints because my writing isn't standalone as much as it maybe should be. It more fits into a storyline. Mm-hmm. So buying one print of a comic never worked out well for my audience. However, a couple things. Number one, I would default to print on demand for a couple of reasons. Number one, if you're going to print this yourself, now you've got to have a really good printer and you've got to buy the ink for the printer. And that ink is expensive.
And by the way, so just so people know, what Brad's talking about is he and I both know a couple cartoonists that own one of those like Epson SureColors, and they're really nice printers to have at home, but they're about $1,000 to $2,000. So you better make a lot of money on prints if you're going to do one of those nice Epsons. So keep going, Brad. Go ahead.
And the ink itself is very expensive, and so you're constantly coming up with that, plus just the time to print it out and do all of that physical stuff. You're really the return on investment in terms of what they're paying for and how much work you're putting in to make that money is not great. So I would default to a print on demand situation. And in fact,
Brad, we're a year and a half into the show. A year and a half into the show. I want it to be so that you can teach an old dog new tricks. I want that to be our mantra. You can teach an old dog a question answer.
Well, I'll just use this person's name, Carrie. I'd like Carrie to consider, if not print on demand, like Redbubble or something like that. Doing what you do, in other words, keep an ear to the ground onto which comic really, really was resounding in the response, and start offering some of those as posters. In fact, here's really what I think Carrie should do. Offer this stuff on print on demand and see, number one, if people actually bite. You know, let's see what the demand for this actually is. And if there is a demand, okay, so you're gonna make small margins on that first little bit.
Right.
But in offering these things print on demand, then you can see which ones were really, really popular with people actually putting their money down on it. And I would say take those and turn them into posters like Dave was talking about, and then offer those posters as standalone merchandise.
Right.
What do you think about that approach?
I mean, listen, as far as dipping a toe into the water, print on demand is fine. It's just as our question asker intimated, the margins are terrible in print on demand. Like she'll be making a dollar, you know, if that on a print. It's terrible. But here's another reason that I didn't mention for when I have pre-printed prints, why I'm moving away from it. Frankly, the margins aren't that much better when I do it as a run of 100, 200 and store them in my studio. It's the margins just aren't great, which is why I'm getting out of it. Like, as I've said repeatedly elsewhere, I try to do margins of 4x or 5x cost. And some of these prints are getting into like 3x cost. And that's not great. Like, that's not, you're like, A, you're in general, you're only selling them for 10, maybe at best, if it's a big one, $15. And so you're not making a ton of money when the cost of goods sold was $2.50 to $4 to print that dang thing up. And then, by the way, they're super easy to ding or scratch. And so you have a fair amount of damaged goods by the time that print run of 300 is sold out. And so anyway, long story short, they're not very big on margin. They're tricky to ship, and they're easily damaged. So in general, one of the reasons why, and also they take up a lot of table space at conventions, one of the reasons why I'm shifting away from prints and moving more towards pins, which we've talked about in the past, enamel pins, which are indestructible compared to prints. They store very small in suitcases and easily displayed on tables. The margins are 4x to 5x cost, and they can do small runs very cheaply. So that's why I would recommend to you and to other people, if you're thinking about a print, maybe think about a pin. And I know that they are apples and oranges, but just have a thought to that.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics. Oh, and Dave, while we're talking here, I've got a topic that I wanted to pitch to you. This isn't coming from a Patreon backer. Actually, it did originally, but it was a few shows back, and I had a little experience that I wanted to talk a little bit more, because it brought up something that I think is really worth talking about. Sound good?
All right. Yep. Yeah, let's do it.
So at the risk of, and I don't want this person to feel like I'm beating up on him, because I'm not. But it's something that is so important mindset wise that I wanted to bring it back. And that was this: we had a Patreon backer that said, geez, I think social media is fool's gold because I get these posts that go very viral, and I'm not seeing anything from it. And we had that experience where we took a look at some of the posts that this person had made and said, well, you don't have hyperlinks. You're expecting them to type in the link that you've got in the image. And if it's not clickable, it's not usable. You know, we've had that whole conversation.
Right.
And we said, you know, let's maybe there's some other ways that you could attempt to do this. But at the same time, I said, I'm super jealous, because I can never get a post to go viral to the extent that this person did. And they were doing it with a great degree of regularity. I mean, this person was knocking it out of the park in terms of generating viral numbers. That was making me green with envy. Well, lightning finally struck. in the same sense that a broken clock is worse, is right twice a day. I had a post that for some reason, and it was basically I had posted it on Imgur. It was a Evil Inc. Half page comic that was maybe 7 or 8 panels that I did in a vertical panel by panel scroll. And I had done these twice a week and posting them on Imgur and Reddit for weeks, and got moderate results, you know, just kind of a heartbeat. I still do it just to kind of experiment more than anything else. And
for some reason, one of them hit and just went through the roof, got on Imager's front page, the most viral page, at which point it really took off and caught fire. It's kind of speaking about a gambler's mentality. Man, I'm chasing that dragon now like crazy because I want that to happen again, you know? And it's like you start get superstitious. Well, what color shirt was I wearing when I posted it?
Right, right.
Yeah. You get down to that level, right? So I finally lightning strikes and I hit something that this person had done with regularity. I hit a viral post. And I noticed that since I had done hyperlinks, I had put them in the comments and it's worth spending a little bit of time learning the social media foibles and like the secret language that each social media use. If you say source in Imager, you're immediately notified, or you show yourself as an outsider. In Imager, it's sauce, not source. I learned that. And if you want to pass as one of them,
oh, for God's
you say
sake.
Sauce instead of source, right?
Man, nerds. Hello. All right,
I'm telling
you.
But know, it's like just, learning the language. It's worth time learning the little
I
ins
know.
And outs.
It's just nerds are nerds no matter where you go. Keep going.
So I had posted not only a link back to my site, which has tons of Patreon outreach on it, obviously, and a place where they could go to the beginning of the storyline. And I also did a hashtag that you could technically read most of this storyline just by hitting the Imager hashtag Evil Inc. and going through all of the different vertical scrolls that were there. So when this thing went viral, I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see, you know, did this work or not? I picked up a couple extra Patreon backers over the weekend, like immediately, and I had increased traffic to my site and increased interest for the next like 2 or 3 days. I could see the effect of it. And it got me really kind of reflecting on this conversation in which I had two takeaways. And the main takeaway is not I did it and you didn't, na 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 na. You know, this isn't that's not really what this is about, where I say, well,
because that's the takeaway I took from it, Brad. That's the takeaway I got.
No. There's a bigger thing at stake here that I really want to talk about. Not, you know, well, you just gotta learn to do it like me. I do everything right. That's not the takeaway. Here's the takeaway though, and it's something that's really, really important in a life approach like to this philosophy, if I can say the word. It's a philosophy.
Nope, you can't. Okay, keep going.
So here's the deal. Next time that you're in this situation, not only this person, but you, the podcast listener, anybody, my advice, next time you're in a situation when something doesn't happen the way you expected it to, don't immediately jump to the system is broken. What I've been told about the system is wrong. Don't immediately jump to that social media is fool's gold. What I want you to get into the habit of doing, instead of doing that, is to say, what about my approach could I have done better? What about this? Maybe did I not do as well as I could have? Is there something about my approach that I could improve? It's such a different mindset to get into, instead of saying, well, it didn't work for me, it must be broken.
Right.
And instead get into, didn't work for me, what could I do better next time? It's a mindset that I really want to encourage you to get into, because it makes all the difference in the world. If you don't ask that question, could it be me? You're never going to get further along in the answers that could lead you to some places that right. make this thing all of a sudden click for you. Right. You see what I'm trying to say?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think not assuming that the system is broken, or even if the system is broken, assuming that how you can do better, how you can work through it or around it or with whatever remaining elements do work, I think, Brad, that's the best advice we can be giving in these recent weeks. I'm seeing that trend over and over again about, this or that aspect of comics is not working. Well, find the elements that are working, or find a new way that is working and take control of your future.
Yeah,
and so
innovate.
I think that, Innovate, yeah, and frankly, innovate. It is a time of real change in the way that it was for comic strip cartoonists a decade ago, and it is it's coming again in a more broader sense. And so, I think that's great overall advice, Brad.
Yeah, it's just something I wanted to bring up as a callback to that earlier show, because it really it's something I found myself getting a little passionate about. It's like, yeah, doggone it. If that happens to you, you got to get into the mindset of how am I going to make that work? You know, and that's because, and I'll tell you why, because then when you innovate something that Dave didn't think of and I didn't think of, then you write into the show next week and say, this thing didn't work for me and here's how I made it work. And then we can steal that from you. I mean, we can borrow some of that wisdom and everybody can go and make all the boats rise, as it were.
Well, there. Okay. Now, I know you were half joking there, but there is some truth to the fact that 50, 100, 200 cartoonists all trying to innovate, one will hit on something and then like lemmings will all go, yes, that works. Let's incorporate that into our business plan. And then somebody else over here in Nevada will innovate something else and we'll all go, great, I'll include that in my business plan too. And then someone up in Toronto will say, well, what about this? And we'll, and, you know, so what I'm getting at there is that if you have 200, 300, 400 cartoonists, professional cartoonists all trying to innovate or all desperately trying to find the next new thing, when it hits and the people that are savvy and paying attention, they will quickly incorporate that into their business plan, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like an immune system to failure, if you think about it, Brad.
Yes. Well, and I guess that's why I wanted to bring it back with this one particular person, because he's getting viral so often with such regularity. If I can get this person into an innovation mindset, he's going to find the next big thing, or he's got a really good position to experiment on a level that I can't, because I only go viral once a year, twice a year, right? But if this person gets into an innovation mindset, they've got a much better chance of finding something that we'll be talking about on the show in a few months.
Well, we hadn't planned to talk about this, but I wanted to mention the opposite of an innovation mindset. And Brad and I saw this yesterday in a series of tweets that were public. One artist was talking about how traditional print and publishers and the advances or the pay rates of publishers weren't working for her. And she's been working in comics for 30, 40 years, right? And a reader responded, Brad, and what did that reader say to her? Do you remember
the
this?
Reader basically said, oh, why? I wish you had a Patreon. I would immediately sign up to support you on Patreon.
And her response was, oh, no, I couldn't ask people for money for my work. I couldn't do that directly. And Brad and I, reading this third party, are kind of screaming into the ether going, what? This is literally what you want. It's a reader saying, I want to support you. And and in the meantime, she's like, no, nothing can be fixed. It's all ash and woe. Print is falling apart.
I don't want, and not only that, but she goes on, the part that made Dave and I absolutely cringe, she goes on to say, you know, the person brings it back, this reader whose heart was in absolutely the right place. This reader said, no, I'm serious. I really would like to support you on Patreon. You should really look into this. And this cartoonist's response was, well, that seems like an awful lot of work. God. Could you imagine?
Well, and then the follow-up that has been like, in my career, I've done food stamps. I've had to do this. Or I've had to take second jobs. And Brad and I were thinking, well, all that takes work too. Maybe just set up a Patreon. For God's sakes, just innovate, you know, like try it.
Being poor is an awful lot of work.
Having a second job is an awful lot of work. For God's sake, like, I don't understand. It's either the imposter syndrome or a guilt syndrome of not wanting to ask readers directly for money, but it's okay for a publisher to ask readers for money and then give you 1/10 of what they got from readers. That's okay, but it's not okay for you to directly interact with your readers. I don't understand that.
And by the way, let's get through this real quick. You can set up a Patreon on a Saturday afternoon. It's not a lot of work. In fact, it's no work. And until you get to the point where you're really trying to use that as your main source of income, in which case it's work that you'll gladly do. But if you wanted to set up a Patreon and just do it as what I've in the past called tip jar, and really what it is a reader support Patreon, If you wanted to do that and set it up by just say, hey, support my comics, $2 a month or whatever, you could set that up in a Saturday afternoon. Yeah. There's no, it's saying that it's a lot of work is it's almost like you're sitting there with a broken leg and somebody comes up and says, oh, hey, well, listen, I got this cast for you. Hey, I can make that leg stop hurting. Here's a little ibuprofen and a splint and some gauze. And you go, well, yeah, well, geez, that seems like an awful lot of work.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, let me tell you, I'm going to give you my own counterexample to that because it's okay. Helpful, I think, to hear me struggling, right? Because we often talk about like, oh, it's, well, you can do it. You can chase those dreams and reach for the stars. But here I am currently struggling with some type of innovation that I've wanted to make, which is I have seen that the direct distribution market or direct market for comics is really breaking down in the last few years. I've also seen that because postal mailing rates have gone up in the last 3 to 5 years, that my own direct sales on my site is diminishing of my books, mm-hmm. right? Because they weigh a lot and not everybody wants media mail and international readers can't use media mail. So I've been looking for another solution. I've been trying to innovate. And one of them in talking to Brad was, well, have you considered going directly through Amazon? And I said, I never wanted to work with Amazon. Blah, blah, blah. But then once I got over my own inability to see innovation, I'm like, you know what? You're right. I should be doing Amazon. I should try that. People with Prime will love it. They'll be able to get a Sheldon book. I'll have less margins, but maybe I'll be getting a lot more Australian, New Zealand, German, Sweden readers buying it because they can do it through Amazon shipping rates. Anyway, it has been a pain in the ass, a stumbling pain in the ass to get onto Amazon. And I've been failing a lot and it's not been easy, but it's not just, I haven't been going, well, it's hard. I'm going to give up. It's been like, no, I need to do some form of innovation long-term for the next 2 to 5 years for how I get books to people. And Amazon is one of a couple different paths that I'm exploring. So even though it's hard, I've got to innovate on this. And that's the counterpoint to going, well, Patreon looks hard. I don't know about that. Okay, even if it is hard for you, even if you're older and not used to Patreon or doing that kind of distributed fundraising, it is worth, as Brad said, spending the Saturday, spending a couple Saturdays, and just starting. No one's expecting you to jump out of the gates with $10,000 a month. But if you can get a couple hundred bucks, a couple dozen bucks for the effort, who cares? It's a start that you can build on. So innovate is the short version of that. I don't know. I got very flustered about that, about how important that is.
Well, you mentioned a key word there, and that was old age. And that you might want to see our next question from a Patreon $5 backer, because it specifically mentions aging. So we've got a really good transition here into another fantastic topic. And this is from Alexander Loken. And Alexander says, as a professional YA author and sometimes comic book creator, I often meet other writers and artists. And one subject that constantly comes up is what we will do when we reach old age. How long will we have to work or to be able to work? Will we still be relevant? Will we have a sustainable pension? And then here's where I live in Norway, where the social benefits are great. Thanks a lot. Rub it in, Alexander.
Two Americans shaking their fist at you. All right. Yeah,
but I know things are different in the U.S. Yeah, no kidding. What are your thoughts? How do you plan for old age and your possible retirement? Thanks for making a great show. Yours truly, Alexander, pushing 40. Well, let's answer Alexander pushing 40 with a couple of guys. Well, you're a little younger than I am. I'm pushing 50. You're still well in your 40s. What do you think about old age, Dave?
Well, listen, as a friend of someone who, Brad Geiger, who is literally foot in the grave, like he's just on the edge of it.
Tell me about it.
I thought that would get a laugh out of you, and it got this reaction. Oh, boy, it's true. Oh, God. I was expecting a raucous laugh, and I got the, oh, you don't know how close you are to the truth, my
one
friend.
One foot on a grave, one foot on a banana peel, man.
Ah, that was such a great image. So the way to frame Alexander's question, the answer to Alexander's question, is that there's three things. One is mindset, one is finances and how to get them in order, and one is actionable steps that you can take for old age, right? So those are the three things that we should talk about. And the first one that I want to talk about is mindset, because this directly translates into what we were just talking about. So yesterday, Brad and I got worked into a frothy madness over this set of tweets from this cartoonist about, like, I want to support you on Patreon. No, that just seems hard. And also, I don't want to ask for money from readers. Brad and I were whipped into a rage about this. And I said to Brad, Brad, don't ever let us get this way when we turn 50, 60, 70, where we don't, we stop innovating, where we stop trying to find out what the new or better way to do cartooning is. And Brad, Brad's response to me, he goes, I'm 50. If it hasn't happened to us yet, we're still innovating and we're still constantly afraid of what the next change is going to be.
Yeah.
And looking to prepare for it. So he goes, if it hasn't happened to us,
Dave goes, how do we avoid it turning into this when we're in our 60s? And I said, the same way we avoided it when we turned into our 30s, the same way we avoided it in our 40s, the same way we're avoiding it in our 50s. Listen, if it hasn't happened to you by now, you've got the mindset. You've got it in you to keep innovating and changing. I would be reticent to get too complacent by saying, well, I'm inoculated against it. It'll never happen to me. But, you know, I think if you've made it this far in webcomics, you've already survived at least what I can point to as two major upsets in the business and publishing environment of webcomics. As long as you keep doing what you're doing, I don't think you got to worry about your 60s. You've got it. You've got the eye on the ball, right?
I wish I had it at the ready, but there was a quote that Jack Welch had, the CEO, former CEO of GE. Mm-hmm. And it's something like, always be afraid, but always, the point of it though, was always have your head on a swivel, you know? And we've seen a lot of careers where the person goes, wow, this newspaper money sure is sweet. And never looking around to see the changes happening. And so you become like a lobster in a slowly boiling pot, you know? Slowly boiling pot. Come on, David. And and the same kind of thing we're seeing now is happening with print publishing and books. And people are like, this was always the way to do it. It's doing great. I'm going to stay doing this. Meanwhile, the temperature of the water is slowly reaching boiling. And so Brad's point is, if you've kept your head on a swivel when you're 30s and the 40s and your 50s, you'll keep doing it into old age. So that's mindset. Yeah. That's the one thing that it informs both of the latter two points that we need to talk about. So Brad, the next one is finances. How do you prepare for old age with finances?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I'll let you know when I reach it. Right now, with my two boys, our finances are, for the most part, aimed at, you know, getting them into and through college. With putting and frankly, it's a partnership between me and my life partner. Carolyn really is kind of doing the heavy lifting in terms of savings, because through her job, she can put together a pension and a 401k and stuff like that. My suggestion is use your own life circumstances to do what you can, but definitely be doing something, because, the years keep going by, and they, for some reason, keep going by faster and faster. And so if you're in your 30s, your 40s are going to sneak right up on you. And if you're in your 40s, here come the 50s. It's something that you're going to have to start as early as you can. And even if it's just putting a little bit away, or even if it's a partnership between you and your spouse or you and your partner, that's something that you should absolutely be planning on. What are your thoughts on that? Yeah, I got a feeling you're going to have a better system in place than I do. What are your thoughts?
Well, there are 1,000 articles that you can look up and books to confirm this point. But one key point is, with very small amounts, you should start saving when you are young. And I know that doesn't help if you're 65 or 55 or 45. But to all the cartoonists that are in their 20s and you're like, I don't have any money to save. I'm barely living, hand to mouth. Honest to God, saving a dollar, $5 a month in a separate bank account, or in an IRA, or even a rolling over CD, with compounding interest over 40, 50 years, it's such a difference compared to when you're suddenly 55 and you go, oh God, I got to build up my savings quick. You know, it's a really hard way to do it. So tiny amounts over decades versus the panic large amount of saving in your 55 is infinitely better for about five mathematical reasons. So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is, so Alexander is in much better shape in Norway with both their tax rate and their retirement system than America's smaller tax rate and our Social Security system, which has the potential. I don't think it will, but it has the potential to have trouble by the time we are all going to retire. And so in part, you have to build up a saving system, whether it's through IRAs, your 401ks, your the stocks you or you know, the hedge funds that you're not hedge funds. Listen to me, not a hedge fund. but what you know, however, whatever investments platform you want to put forward, even if it's just say straight up savings, you should a little bit assume that the government might not be there for you with the Social Security net in the U.S. Because then if it is, great gravy, how fantastic for you. But if it's not, then you've built up a nest egg that you can rely on. And my continuing thought with that is, another thing though, and this is broader, separate from finances, is that one of the reasons that my heart breaks for a lot of these cartoonists that work with publishers is that long term, they all end up with GoFundMe accounts to help pay for their liver problem that they're having in their 60s.
Yeah, it's the truth.
And
yeah,
you see all these older cartoonists that are in their 60s and 70s now, and they don't have two nickels to rub together because they never owned anything that they created. They created some of the most fundamental and culture-changing work in American comics, but they didn't own it. And so they get to their retirement years, and one of the biggest assets that they should have, which is all the physical work that they did drawing for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, they don't own. So they can't tap into that as a form of continuing revenue. And you compare that to how Jeff Smith is going to feel when he's 70, or Phil Folio is going to feel when he's 70, and you see the difference between somebody who worked for Marvel or DC and now is 70 versus Jeff Smith or Phil Folio, who owns everything that they created. And is, you know, aside from Shazam for Jeff Smith, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Anyway, what I'm getting at there is, again, this goes back to a longstanding argument that I have, but own your work, control your work. Long term, you will be so much happier that you did. Is it harder to start up that way? Absolutely. But it also, I always say that it brings you more joy and brings you more freedom and brings you more income in the short term. But to this question, it also brings you more security, way more security in the long term when you own it. Because even if 20 years from now you decide to sell your titles to Scholastic or to Abrams or somebody, that's fine. That was your choice to do it. But you've owned it and can sell it again when you're in your 50s or 60s, you know?
Right. Well, and like we've talked about for a long time, if you own your stuff, you can repackage it. You can re-release it. You know, it's like that whole idea of putting out a graphic novel. And then when you've got three graphic novels, you can put out, you can repackage those into a bigger graphic novel. And then you can repackage those bigger graphic novels into an omnibus. And you know, you since you own that stuff, and if there's still a market for it, of course, you can repackage it and re-release it and generate money that way. But this whole idea of it seems to keep being a surprise to the younger generation that if you work for a corporation and suddenly that corporation cuts you loose when you're not as useful to them, this whole idea of continually being surprised about that, it doesn't hold water. It mystifies. Not only does it not hold water with me, but it mystifies me how you can be a younger cartoonist in this day and age with this much comics history out before you, easily at your grasp, easily found, easily researched, Googled, forget research, Google some of this stuff and find out about those animators who aren't getting paid for working, 60-hour weeks to crank these films out. And then all of a sudden it comes time to pay them and nobody's writing the check.
Right.
Look at some of these people that signed contracts and that were horrible contracts. Look at all of these artists who said, I don't want to know the business part. I just want to be an artist.
Right.
I'm going to take, Dave, I'm sorry. I'm going to take a tangent here.
No, take it. Take it, because I like where you're going.
Come along with the ride with me, Dave.
I like where you're going.
I was just talking to a person Of course, I'll start here. You know, one of my passions has been talking about business and entrepreneurship to art students, because my feeling has long been that art schools nationwide are failing our art students by not telling them basically that this whole idea of getting a job after an art school graduation is a job climate that hasn't existed for 20 years. For the most part,
right.
Illustrators, designers, these people are all going to be freelancers. They're going to be contract employees. They're going to be small business owners. This whole idea of going to work for an ad agency long term hasn't been the case for decades. This whole idea of being a designer, this whole idea, and certainly for those of us who are comics artists, those jobs are contracting and contracting. There's fewer and fewer. And so I got a chance to talk to this person that had been for the last several years doing exactly what I've been talking about doing, offering business training to art school students.
Right.
We happened to find each other, and I'm like, you're doing the kind of work that I've always talked about doing. You got to talk to me about this. And we're sitting there, we're talking, and he goes, guess what the biggest pushback is from my offering these courses? And I said, what? I said, I know exactly what the pushback is. I forget about guessing games. It's the faculty.
Yeah, that's what I would guess. The faculty, yeah.
Right? He says, no, it's the students.
Really?
I go, are you shitting me? He says, the biggest pushback I get by far is from art school students who, if they do get, like number one, they don't electively show up to the courses. But number two, if you try to make them show up, if you say this is a requirement or I'm giving you class credit or whatever, if you force this upon them or say you've got to do it, they push back strongly because they came to art school to learn art. They don't need to know business. Somebody's going to handle that for them. And why are you wasting my time? The year is 2019, and that's the attitude that this person told me that he was getting from art school students, and my jaw hit the table.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, in part, partially the school should be blamed for that, because sometimes you just have to be the adult in the room and say, damn it, no, you're going to eat your vegetables. You have to learn business, because if not, you're going to be back here when you're 30 going, oh, I don't know why I can't pay down my student debt, or I don't know why I can't make all my bills. Boy, this is really tricky to make a career out of this. Oh, I don't know. I mean, I didn't want to learn money, but it sure is the fact that life makes me need to learn how to use money, you know?
You're either going to learn money or life's going to teach you about money one way or the other. It's going to happen,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, congratulations on having a studio apartment in your 50s then. Good job, you know?
Yeah.
So
I do not understand how somebody who's 20 years old in their 20s can exist with this much information that floats right in front of them day after day, how they don't understand that this world that they think they're going into hasn't existed for decades. I don't understand how it can happen.
Right.
Somebody explain it to me. what's the blinders?
The bigger picture that students and working artists need to know is that mass media as a concept only worked when all media was funneled through 10 to 20 different stakeholders in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
Now that is breaking down, everyone has to have a more independent entrepreneurial career. And so art schools have to teach that. And we, you and I, Brad, have to teach that to both our peers and younger cartoonists. And we have to be taught ourselves,
yeah,
because it's a new system that requires everybody to run and control their own finances and run and control their own business. Because mass media, as it existed for 40 or 50 years, is breaking down now. So all the careers as Alexander was saying, all the careers for YA novelists, all the careers for cartoonists and newspapers, all the people that worked for graphic novelists, that worked for publishers, they're all finding it. Oh, it's not working as well anymore. And it's because mass media is slowly breaking down into micromedia or niche medias. And so we all have to take an independent streak. And Brad, that I'm so glad you shared that story, because that's really frustrating that art schools are finding that.
It was fascinating. And of course, you know, this person was representative of one organization. There might be, I'd love to know, like, I'd love to know, and I'm sure we have people that are from SCAD, for example. I don't know where SCAD stands on this. There are certainly other organizations that are teaching art and comics specifically. If you know of somebody, let's put it this way, Dave. If you know of some organization that's doing it right, and well, I don't want to say doing it right because it's not like this guy's not trying, you know. But if you know of an art school that you think incorporates business and does that well, let us know. Now, we'd love to spread the good word about it because I think it's important if you are, and that's a larger conversation, is it important to have an art school background if you're going into comics? We could talk about that
right.
for an entire show.
Right.
But if that is a choice that you make, you know, who's doing it well out there and why? I think that's a great conversation.
Yeah, I would love to hear from any readers or listeners that might know. So if you do happen to know one that like, hey, they have this really good, even if it's just a business 101 program, or an accounting 101 program. I think that's a great thing to give a shout out to. So please do pass that along to Brad and I.
Yeah. Now, Dave, you said that this particular topic broke down into three sections: mindset, finances, and a third one. Have we covered that one yet?
The third one was actionable steps, and I think we did that through mindset and through finances. So.
Good.
In general, very though, Alexander, I think it's kind of like to Brad's old point, the very fact that you are worried about not aging in a way that is, you know, would be detrimental to your career means that you are probably keeping your head on a swivel and keeping open to change, open to modifying the way you do things and learning new systems. And that's the most helpful thing you can do going into your old age, I think. Don't you think, Brad?
Yeah, I think so. So, Dave, we're right near the end of the show, and we've got one Patreon question that it's not quite comics related, but I thought we'd sneak it in just at the end of the show before we run out of time. What do you think?
Okay, will you read it in your more sultry voice, Brad?
Oh, you're asking for it. All right, here
all right.
It goes.
Okay, here we go. This wedding ring comes right off, Brad. It comes right off.
Hey, guys. You actually sound really good on your podcast compared to other podcasts I listen to. I know Brad is planning on upgrading audio gear, but I was curious, what do you use or recommend for microphone, hardware, and software?
Well, Bradley J. Geiger, it's funny that this person should ask. So we are the Patreon support of the show. One of the things that we have long term is to upgrade both of our audio equipment. What we have right now is pretty good, but we kind of want to next level it. So if and when you can support the show, that's one of the things we would like to do is up our physical podcasting equipment. But let's describe for everybody what we use in both of our little podcasting situations and then go from there. Don't you think, Brad?
Okay. Well, I've got a Blue Yeti microphone that I bought with Patreon funds. By the way, I upgraded my old microphone, so I've got a Blue Yeti, and that's inside of a cardboard box stuffed with blankets, and of course the blanket over my head. And I've got a little pop screen in front of the microphone, so when I make my peas, I don't spit all over the microphone.
Thank God.
And that's really the microphone setup over here. I think it's probably a little similar to yours. What do you have over there, Dave?
So Brad and I have matching Yeti microphones. They're kind of for early level podcasting. They're kind of industry standard good ones. And there's four settings on that Yeti, and we have it the single setting of one person recording into the microphone. We both have that. I also have a spit guard. Hanging in front of my microphone. Underneath my microphone, I have a shock mount, which is a round series of concentric circles that's held together by elastic, so that if anything around the microphone gets bumped, the microphone itself does not have a transmitted vibration go through the microphone, right? So there's that. And then that is mounted on I think it's either called a Rode or a Rodey swivel arm for the microphone. And then the microphone itself is encased inside of basically it's a laundry basket I bought from Target that I cut the bottom out of. And then I have bed egg crate foam all around the inside of the box. So that captures a little bit of the bouncing and redirected sound so that the mic only gets it from one source. And then Brad and I both are plugged into Apple computers, and we are recording using a software system that is cloud-based called Zencastr, ZenCastr.com. And as it's funny that I should bring this up, because I was just saying before we started the show, 95% of the time, Zencastr works amazingly. But the 5% of the time that it doesn't work, boy, does it shit the bed. So I would recommend.
But that's, I mean, we should say that 95% is solid. We've only had a couple times, and usually when we're trying to bring like a third person on, that we're bringing in a whole different set of variables with that person's microphone and stuff like that. That's usually when we've had the most problems.
Yeah, yeah. And,
right?
And it's usually because we have systems that are ready for it, and other people are like, yeah, I'm going to be recording for my iPhone headphones. And we're like, all right, I guess you can do it that way. And so their setup is not quite ready to have Zencastr launch. But that is basically it. And then from there, we have, thanks to Patreon support, a professional editor, Matt Woodard, who edits the show every week, probably cleans up the audio in ways that Brad and I don't understand, with both algorithms and just the ear of a professional audio technician, cleans it up. And then from there, we put it onto Simplecast. Right, Brad, you want to tell them about Simplecast?
Yeah, we've become really big fans of Simplecast. We switched in January, and it enables us to put out clips that are really attractive on social media. We like the interface for the most part. I'm not crazy about how we have to type in the show notes, because doing something like bulleted lists is really difficult, which should be, and hyperlinks. Those are both much more difficult than they should be. But the usability of Simplecast overall is fantastic. And some of the things they've got on the horizon, I think, are really going to be great. So big fans of Simplecast as podcast publishers.
They're more affordable than Libsyn, right?
Yeah. Yeah. By a couple bucks a month.
And I think both at Patreon and afterwards, we have found a more willing and supportive, support system whenever we've had to email or reach out to Simplecast. So we would recommend that one. Anyway, and then it goes up on Patreon, and then Simplecast, so separate from the RSS feed on Patreon, which doesn't have any mid-show advertising on it, and also mm-hmm. contains our Pro Tip show, which is the podcast we record just for Patreon backers. And I think there's like 18, 19 hours of that now that are available just for Patreon folks. So that RSS feed goes from Patreon, so it includes both Comic Lab and Comic Lab Pro Tips for everybody. And then the Simplecast propagates it throughout a bunch of different podcast networks and systems. And that's how we make that's how we make Comic Lab.
That's how we make the soup.
And so, like innovating with your career, we've made mistakes as we got this started, this show, and we're still very much learning. But the idea is that we're just constantly keeping an eye out for what's new and different and how other people are running their podcasts. So that's why we were happy to answer this question for you, because it's worthwhile to share this information in general, just because it makes the overall podcasting landscape better. So anyway, that's that for how we make Comic Lab.
Fantastic. And on that note, you have been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode, as all episodes, was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab.